Welcome to the Between the Scans podcast, your on-the-go source for imaging trends happening in the healthcare market. Whether commuting to work, taking a break, or just winding down for the evening, Shared Imaging has got you covered with the latest and greatest in diagnostic imaging news. On today's podcast, we welcome our guest, Bill Faulkner with William Faulkner & Associates, who will discuss the importance of MRI safety. Today's host is Judy Ficke, Director of Safety and Regulatory Compliance for Shared Imaging.
Welcome to Between the Scans podcast. My name is Judy Ficke, and I'm excited to be hosting today's podcast and even more excited about our guest, Bill Faulkner. Bill is currently working as an independent consultant through his company, William Faulkner & Associates, providing MRI and CT education, as well as MRI safety and clinical operations consulting for over 25 years. His clients have included healthcare facilities and medical companies such as GE, Philips, Siemens, Aspect Imaging, Invivo, Medtronic, Abbott, Nevro, Inspire, and Bracco Diagnostics. He has been teaching and lecturing on MRI for over 35 years. Bill is the author and co-author of several MRI-related books and papers. He is an active member and fellow of the SMRT, serving as the first president. Bill is a credentialed MR safety officer, and he is a founding board member and currently the chair of the American Board of Magnetic Resonance Safety. Welcome, Bill, and thank you so much for taking some time out to chat with me today.
Thanks, Judy. I appreciate the introduction. Dang, I should go give myself a raise, maybe.
I think you should.
Or maybe just take some time off. It made me tired. I do appreciate you asking me to spend some time with you, talk over, I think, some important concepts relating to MRI safety. So I'm ready whenever you are.
Okay, great. So, Bill, do you feel we're having more MR safety incidents, or are we just seeing more being reported?
Yeah, that's a really good and interesting question. And to be truthful with you, I don't know that I know the answer. I can tell you my feeling. Okay.
Okay.
First off, we know for a fact that the great majority of MRI incidents are not reported. There is no mandatory reporting type mechanism, generally speaking. The vendors, the equipment vendors, are required to report incidents to the FDA if they are reported to the vendor. But the users of the equipment are not necessarily required to report any incidents. The FDA and those of us in MRI societies, we've always encouraged people to do that because you can learn from that. But for probably obvious reasons, there's this hesitancy and for stuff not to be reported. Based on something I've heard Dr. Canal, Annie Canal, say a couple of years ago, based on his knowledge of the way things work in Pennsylvania, he's in Pittsburgh, based on that, his estimate, because apparently stuff's reported more in Pennsylvania, supposedly.
Okay.
Maybe they're required to or something like that. But anyway, based on that and then kind of extrapolating stuff, it's probably estimated that less than 10% or less of incidents are actually reported to the FDA. And the problem is the FDA has this thing called MedWatch database. And anybody, you can go online and type in MedWatch, and anybody can report anything. So, lay people, and if you ever read through it, you'll find a lot of those. So anybody can report it. So there's double reporting, there's inaccurate reporting. There's all kinds of things. And in fact, the FDA says that this MAUD, which is an acronym for something, device user experience or something like that, that this database should not be used for any scientific data. I mean, the FDA themselves says it's not scientific. it's not. That being said, though, I mean, that's really about the only thing we have. So number one, it's a long way of saying I believe they're grossly underreported. I think with social media now, more stuff is leaking out, right? So it's not really getting reported. It's like pictures and stories get out on social media. And a problem with that is social media, because how do you know, how accurate what, you know, people are saying? Then people start talking about it. It's like that game of gossip when you're a kid. By the time it gets around the circle, you know, it's different than when it started. But I do think more accidents are happening. I do have that feeling. And the reason I have that feeling is that we have, in my experience, having done a lot of safety audits and risk assessments at sites, basically see new technologists coming into the field. They're exposed to these institutionalized practices, and it's accepted as the way things work. And the technologists in general, new technologists coming on the scene today, I don't think are as well educated in the fundamentals of MRI and fundamentals of certainly MRI safety. Things are more complicated from a safety standpoint than they were back in the 80s, the mid 80s when I started, when we were scanning early days. They're much more complicated, and it requires a really good understanding of MRI physics to work through the safety concerns. I think there's a lot of drivers that are creating more dangerous circumstances and stuff. So, you know, I guess my answer is yes to all. I think they're not all reported. I think more are being reported, probably through social media. I do think more are happening because our technology is getting more complicated. And right. My Lord, that went on for a long time. I apologize.
Okay. So, but you already answered my next question was, is reporting incidents, near misses, or accidents mandatory? You've already said it's not. If it, do you feel that it should be? Because when accidents are reported, then I would hope that people, I know I do, look at the accident. I look at it, you know, to our situation and think, is it possible that that could happen in our facility or facilities or on our systems? If so, do we have a gap and how can we close it? So if there was mandatory reporting, do you feel that the majority of those in the MR safety or MR field would say, hang on a minute, we got to look at our practice and see if we're as safe as we need to be?
Well, let me ask you this question then. Let's talk about this for a second. I see two things here in terms of quote mandatory reporting. And in fact, I've been reading some stuff online. People for years, you know, a lot of people have been a proponent of some sort of an FAA type oversight. You know, the FAA, from an aviation standpoint, aviation is right. much safer than medical imaging, medicine in general. The pilots are, in fact, pilots are actually encouraged to self-report because there's no punitive steps in that process, okay, from what I've been told by friends of mine who are licensed pilots. Then there's the other part of me that probably doesn't want government in any more areas of my life. That makes sense, right? I mean, you know, be careful what you ask for, you may get it. And I'm sure people have different political views and stuff, but still, you know, I'm from the
That's
government.
That's a fair
I'm
point.
Here, yeah, I mean, I'm from the government. I'm here to help, like Ronald Reagan said, you know, it's the worst words you'll ever hear. And so, you know, I don't know that's necessarily the answer, but so I think now let's talk about from a facility standpoint or a company standpoint, okay? Like shared image, okay?
Okay.
This is where I think, and I've talked with a lot of science about this, is what you consider, what would somebody consider a reportable incident? So let me ask you this. What in security imaging organization would be considered a reportable incident? See, because I think you can require mandatory reporting from a institution standpoint. I think you absolutely can.
Okay.
And I think institutions should, and I think it should be not carrying a punitive stick with it, because the reporting of it, the idea of it, is to make us all safer, right?
Yes.
That's the idea, not to punish, but to improve, you know? So let me go back to that then. From a facility standpoint, what would you consider, what would you think should be a reportable event? And then because we haven't discussed this, and I'll tell you what I'm thinking. But I mean, what do you think?
Okay, so I think anything when you get inside zone three, if there's any item that shouldn't be in zone three, so say, you know, we've seen the images of the shackles in yep. zone four, we consider anything that gets into zone three a near miss. Anything into zone four would be considered an incident or accident. So we want our near misses, even if it goes into zone four and it was caught before there was any damage, or you know, it gets into into the magnet or close to the magnet. It doesn't matter. That's still an incident, even without injury or incident. That's an incident that needs to be reported. If it was into zone three, let's say somebody brought an unsafe oxygen tank into zone three, that's a near miss in zone three. If they cross the threshold into zone four, even if it's caught immediately, we consider that an incident or accident. Not that we still approach it the same way. We still want to look for root cause analysis. Where's our gap? How did this happen? But that's how we differentiate. So anything into zone three is where we start to say this needs to be addressed or reported.
I'm actually a very close agreement with you. I'm going to give you my little phrasing of it, or looking at it this way. I would always consider anything, or my advice has always been, anything that violates a policy or procedure.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I mean, just take it, you know, so you got a specific thing, like somebody comes into zone three with an oxygen tank. Yeah, okay, sure. Anything in zone three, you know, one door away from the magnet. Anything on wheels in zone three is dangerous. But I would recommend you even take it just a little step further and back down a notch to anything that just violates your policies or procedures. So for example, if you've got, and this is more typically in a hospital setting, you've got a procedure where you've got anesthesia and nursing people in there. And, you know, when they got everything out of their pockets and you've got a secured or quarantined kind of bin or something over there, and somebody goes over and picks up one of their communication devices and then absentmindedly drops it in their pocket and it gets caught. See, to me, that would be a reportable event, because and it's important to track those kind of things, because if this keeps happening, if you can spot these little things that happen frequently, is it happening with one person? Is it happening in one situation? You know, what is to your point, then you can look at it and say, okay, we need to change how we're doing things so that we can minimize even the smallest kind of an issue. And I think it's important for the techs listening and stuff, you know, just because nothing bad happened doesn't mean it's not a problem.
Right.
Doesn't mean it's not dangerous. So, you know, I always tell people, you know, getting away with something doesn't prove safety, because if you've lived past 17 years of age, you're living proof of that, right? So, you know, I would say, like I said, very close to, I think we've got the same opinion here, but I would say that mandatory, it should be mandatory at a facility level. And I think that the counseling part, counselable, that's the word, not punitive, I want to say, would be on not reporting, right? But don't go overboard. I was talking to one tech in a class one time. She said, our manager says we're required to report 5 events a month.
And I'm thinking, goodness.
Well, I'm thinking, okay, hey, let's just don't have any, okay? Right. It seems like it's kind of the wrong way to do it. But I do think I think that's the way to handle it. And not so much on an industry standard level, because I don't think you'll ever do that. But you can mandate it and watch it and have everybody looking for this stuff. And this is what's important. Everybody has to care about this. You can't have just a few people that care about it and other people go, yeah, well, that's just the way it is. It works okay around.
Right. We've always done it that way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, those are, everything works well until it doesn't. Okay.
Yes.
And, those are the ones that worry me, you know?
Right. Right. Excellent point. I like, that you called out anything that violates policy. So, yes, good, great suggestion. Thank you.
Oh, that's so, free. You didn't pay for it. That's
so there's been a lot of discussion recently about remote scanning. I have seen this a lot on, I know I saw Kristen, one of your associates, mm-hmm. give a presentation on this at a seminar that I was attending. It was very eye-opening for me to hear her and her presentation, and it made sense. But I don't think that reasoning has quite made it out to, the general MR population, reading some of the comments on social media. So as far as the remote scanning, which has started in some facilities, mm-hmm. Can you please share a little bit of your experience with the remote scanning and how this may or may not impact safety if it's not developed properly?
Well, I don't personally have any experience with it myself, but I've actually consulted with quite a few folks here recently on this, you know, topic. And of course, the first thing that comes up is always safety, which is interesting to me. Back when 3T was new on the market, we did a lot of MR safety training for sites that were getting a 3T, and they would approach this request for safety training for 3T, something like this. It would go something like, we're going to get a 3T. We need to beef up our safety protocols. We need to review our safety protocols. And my question is always, why? Okay, what is it that you're doing? If you do everything you're supposed to be doing at 1.5, then when you get a 3T, you're really not going to have to do anything. You know, now granted, there are, you know, implant device issues related to field strength. I get that. Everybody gets that. But there's no general practices at 3T that you wouldn't do at 1.5, okay? So taking that same kind of concept is, let's talk a little bit about what remote scanning is and what remote scanning isn't. And keep in mind that I'm going to have that same kind of appearance to it. It's like, okay, what do you need to do with remote scanning that you don't need to do if you're not remote scanning? You know, what is it that would create a safety issue? Okay. So and there's been a lot of stuff on social media that's just absolutely inaccurate with remote scanning. You know, I've had the pleasure of talking with several organizations that are doing this and doing it well. Dr. Manny Cannell has written an editorial on it because they actually do this at University of Pittsburgh. And they went about it in a very organized systematic way. And so I'm gonna borrow a little of Manny Canal's way to describe this because I am.
And
because
you can.
Because I can. But he's got a paper, and it's called Divided Responsibilities or something like that. And in fact, he's going to do a presentation on it on an upcoming free webinar November 21st. For those people out there listening that want to join, you go to my website, t2star.com. And I've got a link to it. In fact, I'm going to be doing a little 15-minute presentation on normalization of deviation, a topic we were really kind of discussing earlier. Mm-hmm. And then Manny's going to do something on remote scanning. So here's kind of the way to look at it. When you, as you're scanning, let's take how we do it in a routine setting. In a routine setting, you've got a technologist. And you may have a second person. Hopefully you've got somebody nearby in case they needed, assistance in something. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, you know, when you're dealing with a patient, you have a technologist dealing with that patient. And that technologist has two responsibilities. They have a patient care responsibility, a safety kind of responsibility, screening the patient, dressing the patient, positioning the patient, padding the patient, communicating with the patient, all of that patient care stuff that is not related to necessarily to performing the exam. And then the other component is the, and I forget Manny's exact words on it, so I don't plagiarize it. So, it's the actual function of doing the scan, right? Literally driving the scanner, doing the scan. So you've got two job functions for the technologists. One requires training, education, credentialing for the most part to drive the scanner, right? The scanning part of it. And there are safety aspects to that, staying within conditions of use, that sort of thing, parameter wise. And then there's the other part, the patient care part, the direct patient care and safety part. So when you do remote scanning, you're going to split those two. Okay, you're going to have one person who's going to have the responsibility of acquiring the data and safely performing the scan from an actual driving the scanner standpoint. And then you're going to have somebody that's got the patient care aspect of it. Okay. So you take those two responsibilities, you just divide it. Okay. Now, so the technologist can actually be driving the scanner from a remote location. They are not driving blindly. They're not flying blindly. The organizations I've dealt with and spoken with and how they've set up their remote scanning is they have multiple cameras. You have at least three cameras. You're going to have one camera that's going to be looking down the bore of the magnet so that the remote scanner, person at the remote scanning sees a live video of the patient in the bore. They can actually, some sites have even put another camera directly over the magnet on the front side so that, for example, if you're positioning a patient or whatever, then the remote tech is looking straight down on the patient from that view. You've got a camera in the control room. And in one particular case, or the way I would do it, certainly, they have literally what is a tablet, so an iPad-like thing, where the remote technologist has direct live FaceTime communication with the person that's at the scanner, okay, the local person. Now, this local person can be an MRI technologist because there are some organizations that use remote scanning for training purposes, right? Education, looking over the shoulder, education purposes for new technologists. I think it's a great, great idea. There are organizations that also use this for difficult cases. So, you know, in organizations, maybe even like yours, in a lot of cases, these organizations will have, or for lack of a better word, a super tech with really experienced techs, or that maybe have experience in cardiac, or somebody else has got experience in breast, or, you know, any of these various subspecialties. And used to, you'd have to schedule them and move them around and all that sort of stuff. But with remote scanning, you can actually have the expert drop in. The local tech gets the patient all ready to go, and then the remote tech, you know, helps them or performs the procedure. Does that kind of make sense? I mean, that's one scenario. Is that kind of going where we're
looking? It does. It makes perfect sense. Absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely. So those are kind of straightforward in where you would have a MRI technologist for whatever reason, level of experience, being backed up by somebody who's got more experience or knowledge in certain, you know, cases. Now, here's the thing: the local person there has to be responsible for all things safety related to that patient. The local person's got to get the patient screened, dressed, ensured that everything's, you know, copacetic with on the screening form and all that sort of thing. The local person, then the remote tech, can also have electronically a copy of the screening, can go over that with the remote tech, you know, just to make sure everything's good to go. Then the local tech will then is responsible for bringing the patient into zone four, getting hearing protection in place, properly positioning the patient, properly padding the patient, ensuring you don't have any skin-to-skin contact, ensuring, you know, the usual stuff you do, getting the patient ready to go. Obviously, coil selection, positioning, that sort of thing. Then landmarking, centering, advancing the scan, you know, getting ready to go, and then coming out, sitting down at the console for now the scan to start. You don't have to be an MRI tech to do that.
Right.
Right? you don't have to be an MRI tech. You can train a suitably trainable person, significantly in MR safety, to understand the positioning, the padding, skin-to-skin contact, all of this, communication with the patient, all of that can be taught to someone from an X-ray tech to what I'll call a tech aid, right? An MR
right.
Tech aid. This has been done in nursing assistants, right? This has been done in nursing, okay, where they've taken that patient, you know, functionality and put it on, you know, someone else, enabling them to do more, okay? This has been done. I see a nurse practitioner, okay? My annual physicals are with a nurse practitioner. Of course, you know, still got the MD there if I need to see him, but I haven't seen him in 3 or 4 years.
Right, okay? Right.
And so I just know my nurse practitioner. Okay, so there's several benefits to this, okay? And I think remote scanning can actually make you safer if done correctly. So we're going to have the caveat, or we're going to say it has to be, this person has to be very, very well, adequately trained. Also, this person, the local person, has to have the ability where they have no other responsibility but that patient from the time they pick them up, take them into zone two, get them screened, get them dressed, bring them into zone three. They're with them the entire time, put them in the scanner, remain in contact with the patient throughout the scan in between series, just like the tech would do in the non-driving functionality. Take all of that, put it in that. And this person has to be has to be uninterruptible. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, this person's got to be focused on that patient and nothing else. Okay. Here's the other benefit of this. Every MRI tech listening knows how much you are distracted when you scan, right? Especially if you're having, you're taking care of the patient. You got the patient care side of things, you got the scanning side of things, and then you got the phone, you got this, somebody's going yelling about this, that, and the other. You're watching all this stuff going on around you, and your attention is actually divided from that patient. The remote scanning location, where a lot of sites are doing it right now, is kind of like a reading room environment. And the only thing the scanning tech is focused on is that exam. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's such focus that it is easily conceivable to do two patients at once. You stagger them. You know, you don't start them and stop them at the same time. But you stagger them because each person has got each, if you're doing two, each one has got that dedicated patient person responsible for the safety of that patient. And I would submit to you that that can actually be a lot safer than the way we do things now.
Sounds like it. Yeah, thanks for that explanation. And
I know, again, I didn't mean to drone on about it.
You touched on a little bit of my next question too. In your presentation, standardization and deviation, I know you mentioned that. And anybody listening, if you haven't seen Bill's presentation on this, I highly suggest it. It is the best MR safety presentation I think I've ever seen. And I've had several years in MR and several MR safety courses myself. But in that, you discussed little deviations from full safety measures that can become big issues. So, you know, little deviations and you get away with it. So you do it again and again and again, and pretty soon that deviation has been standardized and it can open the door for some huge safety issues. Go ahead, Bill.
What I was going to say is, I mean, that's really the key thing that I think people need to understand is that things that go on so long, they literally become unrecognized as a safety problem. They're just not seen as a safety problem. There's a couple of other articles that I've read on this, and I'm pulling some words from these various articles. But it's a concept, and then it goes back to, and I won't go through the whole thing, but it goes back to the Challenger disaster, where these deviations in practices became normalized and it wound up, you know, costing people's lives.
Right.
One of these articles I read pointed to the Titan sub disaster, you know, the submarine submersible disaster from, you know, this past year. But it's a good way to think of this, and I cut this out and wrote this down because I think it's a good way to summarize what this normalization, I've seen it as normalization of deviation and normalization of deviance. It's basically saying you're deviating from a known and accepted standard of practice. We have standards. We have the ACR guidance. We have ACR MR manual, you know, so we know what is safe. But it's a phenomena, so I'm going to quote here from this article, it's a phenomena as occurring when people within an organization become so insensitive to deviant practices that deviate, that it no longer feels wrong. The insensitivity will occur slowly and sometimes over years because disaster doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen until other critical factors line up. So you no longer see it is a problem. And in fact, it becomes the new norm so subtly that any associated risk go unnoticed until you have a catastrophe. And these deviations from practices will occur because you've got barriers, or at least this is what we use as a reason for doing it, to these correct processes. And, you know, people can say time, cost, peer pressure, well, this is just what we have to do. They defend it. They defend, I've heard people defend these unsafe practices as necessary and justified. So I want to give you an example of that, that statement, defending, and I'm talking adamantly defending the practices, okay? We know it is the right thing to do to change all patients out of street clothes because we can talk about this again as well, because of unseen metallic fibers in clothing and stuff like that.
Right.
We know that's the right thing to do. But so was at a site where this site was, I thought, unreasonably focused on staffing. You know, everybody can use more help. Okay. I don't know of anybody that I've ever gone in where they go, oh Lord, we're so overstaffed. That's not funny. We're tripping all over everybody.
Said no one ever.
Yeah. You know, someplace hasn't frozen over yet. You know, I mean, I've just never seen that. And so, at any rate, the problem was at this site that they were so focused on the staffing, they weren't looking at little small things that were extremely dangerous, like really ferrous stuff close to the scan room door and all kinds of little things like that. And anyway, so after we got through with the safety presentation, one of the technologists who had been the most adamant about this staffing issue, sitting across the table from me after we talked about changing patients, crosses her arms and looks at me and says, well, I just don't have time to change every patient. It's just not possible. I don't have time. We've got too many patients. I can't change everybody. So she's, again, adamantly defending her practices. And my response mm-hmm. to her was, well, fine, then just burn them.
Wow.
You know, I mean, go ahead, burn them. Okay.
And then how many
somebody, you can tell them, I'm sorry, I'm just too busy. Okay. So
yeah.
sit over there and treat your wound because I'm sorry, I'm just too busy, you know.
And how many documented cases have we had of burns because of patients not being changed or, into their approved hospital attire? There's been a lot.
Well, funny you should say that. I saw an article that I ran across a few weeks ago. Then this article was published actually they went and gathered as many as they could find. And there's, you know, again, not everything's reported, okay? But in the literature, there's at least a half a dozen, maybe a little more, of documented cases of burns due to fiber in clothing, okay?
Wow.
And, you know, the other thing that I'm actually shocked at, Frank Shellock sent me another article on this. I've got at least 5 documented cases of patients burned when they were using conductive pulse oximetry to monitor the patient during an MRI procedure. And these burns, many of them resulted in amputation.
Oh, boy.
The digit, and in one case, it was a 5-week-old female, amputation from the forearm down, wrist, and hand. Okay. Mm. I mean, it's MRI has to control this environment, and this has to be a top priority for every patient. So you're talking about the prisoner shackles. Okay. I mean, in the last one I saw, most recent one, the prisoner comes in, the corrections officer removes the ankles, removes the belly shackle, and then the tech's taking the prisoner into the room. Well, the corrections officer is coming right behind her, and one of them flies out of his hand, hits the scanner, and I think it hit the prisoner too. Guard hurt his hand, prisoner foot. Not major incident, but the point is, I mean, you see what happened. They know enough to take it off, but then again, your attention's divided or your practices are such that you're doing what you normally do in a rote fashion. So your spidey sense, you know, Spider-Man, spidey sense is a tingling when somebody walks in with these, you know, freaking metal shackles, you know.
Right.
And, you know, and it's easy, you know, again, and I want people to understand this, and I really hope people will take a notice of what I'm about to say here. It's really easy to criticize people Monday morning quarterback camp. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's real easy, especially when you see all this crap on social media and stuff. But I think it's wise, as some wise person once told me, there but for the grace of God go I. And what this does for me as a technologist is it makes me more keenly aware of what's going on around me. And I think that should be the focus. So it's like if remote scanning, just to go back to that for a second, if remote scanning is going to make your facility unsafe, which means, hey, simply we're going to take the technologist and put them in a different location, and all of a sudden that makes safety go to crap, you have problems to begin with. Does that make sense?
Right. It does. Makes perfect sense.
You know, well, I've always said, like, you know, and everybody would agree, the technologist is the last line of defense. But sites have a problem when the technologist is the only line of defense.
Right.
And you know, when you really take a look at it, I think every facility can take a look at how they do things and find that if they're really honest and they look, there are a lot of things that are subtly being done that you can justify and say, well, that's not a problem here because of the way we, you know, because we do this and the other. And, you know, it's something that I think needs to be, in my opinion, the medical adage, first do no harm. So, you know, what we do as MRI technologists, I think every patient that we do, you have to look at the safety from every aspect of it with every patient. It is just as important, not more important, than making sure you're using the right protocol and selecting the right sequences. That is, you know, if that's what you focus on, if you focus on how many slices per TR, because I've cut, drop your TR, it's too long, if all you're focusing on is scan time, right? And getting, you know, getting the next, you know, get this done in and out of here. If that's all you're focused on, then be careful. Be careful, because I think you're not doing the patient justice. I think you're not doing the patient justice, quite honestly.
Right, right. And this is not just patients, correct? This is anybody going into zone four. We did see recently an incident where a patient's son accompanied her into the scan room. This happened in Brazil, well publicized. So mm-hmm. I'm not giving any secrets out here. I hope it's not a huge surprise to a lot of people, but the son, being a big gun advocate, evidently thought that he had the right to carry a gun no matter where he was, and that included zone four. It was not verified, correct, that he had taken his gun off or right. changed into hospital gowns, and the result was the gun discharged and shot him in the abdomen, and he passed away, just a few days later?
Yeah,
so,
yeah, a week later, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
You can't, and to your point, staff screening is very important. For example, that brought to mind, well, here, a recent incident, I was actually contacted by an attorney to gauge my interest in being a witness for this facility on behalf of this facility who's being sued by someone. And this was the incident. The guy was a knife enthusiast. And he came in cargo pants and, you know, summertime attire, and they made him empty his pockets. I later found out, talking with the attorney, you see, their policy is that you don't necessarily have to change everybody. It depends on what you're doing. So anyway, whatever they were doing, you know, he just emptied his pockets, and they said, did you get everything out of your pockets? He goes, yeah, you know, got your pockets. Okay, so they bring him into the scan room in his street clothes, and they put him on the scanner, and as they're advancing him in, one knife he didn't get out of his pocket. He had like five or seven knives. Okay, I'm thinking,
my goodness.
Well,
wow.
You know, I mean, I carry one pocket knife, okay? At any rate, this pocket knife flew out, opened up, cut his arm. I told the attorney, I said, I hate to hear that, but I can't take the case because I can't defend that. I'm not going to defend that. And here's an example of where you've got practices that aren't consistent and aren't based on sound, known MR safety practices. They're based on convenience for the staff.
Right.
Or perceived convenience for the patients. And the patient's fine until they cut themselves. And then, and then they're not going to be. I think there's, and I know we're getting close on time. I don't want too far here, but there are, let me put out a warning of talking about screening patients, is pushing off screening practices on non-MRI personnel. In other words, it's especially in hospitals where there's a tendency to, let's make it more streamlined, then we'll have the nurses screen the patient on the floor in the unit in the ER before they get up here. And most sites will say, yeah, but we do that, but we go over the screening well. Okay, fine. I'll bet you over time what happens up once they get up in the MR department is they're spending less time going over it in detail with the patient, assuming, right, relying on somebody else to be doing the screening. Patient safety screening is an MRI technologist responsibility. It is MR personnel that are trained responsibility, not nursing personnel. Okay. And pushing that off on them does not relieve any liability on the MRI part of it. And that stuff like that, really is something that worries me. And so I would encourage you, take responsibility for that patient. And make sure you're documenting. You talk about nursing walking into the room. I've seen this numerous times where if a nurse comes down to maybe give a little patient a little sedation or some medication, the patient's in the scan room, technologist will say, okay, now you don't have any pacemaker, aneurysm clips, anything metal in your eye, whatever, take everything out of your pockets, get all that out, you take your badge off, take all this stuff, okay, you got everything out of your pocket, right? Going over verbally with them. And then go, okay, go on in. And the nurse goes in, she's in there, he or she is in there 3 or 4 minutes, comes back out, and they're gone. The problem is if you take a scenario where a nurse might have had a bilateral mastectomy and now she's got bilateral tissue expanders and she don't want to tell somebody that, that can be very problematic if you don't have it documented. And this is, another example of taking some type of a policy procedure that we know the way to do it is have it in writing, but because it works better here, if we just, we can just do that and we'll just, we make a note of it and stuff like that. Again, it's all this stuff that becomes, that you know to be correct, but you just begin to vary from it.
Right.
And that's when the danger comes into play there.
Yes, that makes perfect sense. And switching over dangers, we're, if we can kind of go towards the implants, we have a lot of manufacturers now making MR conditional implants. So I know you've spoken on the B1 plus RMS and SAR. Can you go over a little bit more as far as the MR conditional implants following what is conditional about them in order to safely scan the patient?
Yeah, you'll see, you're going to see more and more implants or devices using the metric of B1 plus RMS as the condition of use for radio frequency safety as opposed to SAR. It's been long since stated in the literature that the SAR is a very poor metric for heating. Certainly as it relates to implants and devices. In fact, the SAR estimations that all vendors use do not take into account anything about having some big chunk of metal in the field. And so especially with active implants and devices, SAR can be extremely dangerous because different vendors use their different algorithms. Crap on a Siemens system, if you go in head first versus feet first, it estimates SAR differently. SAR is estimated. It uses assumed patient characteristics like conductivity, circumference, things like that. And SAR is an expression of the rate at which energy is absorbed by tissue. It doesn't have anything to do with an implant or device. SAR is also very conservatively estimated. And so using SAR as a condition of use for implants and devices, particularly active implants and devices, oftentimes results in a very limiting condition. Just at to for the vendors, the device manufacturers just throw in a big fudge factor from a safety standpoint because it's all estimated. So B1 plus RMS is actually a time average of the average magnetic field of the RF pulse. It's measurable. It's in units of microtesla. It's the magnetic field strength. It has nothing to do with the patient's size, has nothing to do with the patient's weight, and it actually is not affected by field strength. It's 1.8 microtesla. I'm just making up a number. 1.8 microtesla on a GE is 1.8 microtesla on Siemens, on Philips, on me, on you. It's much more standard, and it is, again, measurable, not estimated, so it's not as restrictive as SAR. And you're going to see more and more vendors using that. In fact, some device manufacturers don't even test for SAR anymore. They only list B1 plus RMS as the condition of use for RF. And over time, that will be all you see.
Okay.
And so I think it's a great step forward and very useful for implants and devices. I think it's a great bit of standardization that people are starting to use that now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for expanding on that for us. That does make sense to especially when looking at the conditional implants and how to scan them safely. So, I want to be respectful of your time, Bill. If it's okay, I'd like to ask one more question. Another question that came in from one of our customers. Can you talk about the best practice in a hospital versus outpatient setting, especially when it comes to overweight patients? Do you feel that there's a difference between hospital and outpatient settings? And
Absolutely not. In fact, I am familiar with a case right now that a colleague of mine, two colleagues of mine, are actually dealing with the legal case. This was bore wall contact related. Patient was under anesthesia. Bore wall contact. The burn is so bad. Fourth degree burn all the way down through to the ulna. Okay. And it doesn't matter whether that's inpatient or outpatient. Okay. When you've got somebody under anesthesia, they can't communicate with you. So you've got to be even more vigilant. So the best practice is what is recommended by the ACR. The best practice is what is recommended by your device manufacturer. You're the vendor of your MR equipment. And that is you use sufficient space or padding to prevent the patient's tissues getting close to, or even worse, coming in contact with the bore wall. And it's, you know, felt to be at least a centimeter, 2 centimeters worth of padding. If the padding is compressed, then the patient's getting too close to the bore wall. It doesn't matter where you are in that RF coil. The closer you are to the bore wall of the magnet, the higher the amount of RF power that you're getting right there. And so you have to prevent bore wall contact. It wasn't a big deal years ago, but technology has changed, and it's a big deal now. And so all patients should be adequately padded to prevent bore wall contact. If, in my opinion, if you have a patient who cannot be placed into the bore with adequate padding because of the patient's size, that patient cannot be safely imaged. And you need a policy and procedure on how to handle that. And it may result in just calling up the referring physician and go, "I'm sorry, doc, we can't scan Mr. Jones. He's too big to fit into the scanner safely, and he would be coming in contact or close to the bore wall and in danger of significant RF-related thermal burns." Mm-hmm. And you know, and if they say, well, they scanned them down the street, then I say, well, I can't speak to their unsafe practices, but, you know, we're going to be safe. And so to answer that question, any difference in hospital and outpatient, the answer is no. No, they're all dressed in MR appropriate attire, and you pad them. And if you can't pad them because they're too big, then you need a policy of how to handle that, because to scan them without proper padding is indefensible. When they get a burn, it's indefensible. What's the defense going to be? You know,
right?
Because the user manual tells you to use the padding and ACR and education programs such as this tell you to use the padding. That's standard of care. But again, little deviations start to happen. And because nothing bad happens, there's no immediate bad push, you know, immediate bad back, right? And go, that's okay. So, yeah.
Right. And burns in that are happen in MR are similar to any other type of burn, whether it be from a fire or sunburn or whatever. You don't always see that effect immediately. Sometimes it's the next day before, or maybe 2 days later, that effect starts to really go, oh my, this is kind of a bad burn here.
Oh yeah. Well, in fact, especially bore wall contact burns, those burns are almost always delayed burns. The patient really may not feel, like most likely won't feel anything, because the burn is occurring in deep tissues. So they don't notice until several days later when you have the full thickness burn then. Mm-hmm. And you can recover from first and second degree burns, but understand third and fourth degree burns, you got it for life, you know? And while you mention that, it's interesting to note that of all of those we talked about reporting to the FDA, several years ago, a bunch of scientists, engineers at the FDA did a paper on injuries reported to the FDA over a 10-year period. And of those injuries reported to the FDA over that 10-year period, RF-related burns accounted for more than all the other injuries combined. So RF-related injuries were nearly 60% of all reported patient injuries.
Wow.
More than hearing, more than... all the stuff combined, projectile incidents, hearing, you know, that was reported, you know. So it's a major, major issue.
Right, right. Thanks so much for commenting on that, because I feel like that is one of the things that does get missed sometimes, whether it be for convenience or time, or that deviation that nothing's ever happened before. So it's important.
It is. I think it's actually important that you have, if not mentally, you have one literally there in writing, checklist, like a pilot's checklist, where you go over everything to make sure you've covered all your bases. I think safety is assumed, and I think it's grossly underestimated. And sadly, I think a lot of us technologists have fall into that trap of assuming we're doing everything safely.
Right, right. Well, with that, Bill, I want to thank you for joining us today and sharing your vast knowledge and information about safety. And I hope we can do this again sometime in the future.
Sure. I mean, absolutely fine with me, you know.
I tell people safety is my favorite topic, and I think that's one of your favorite topics too. So I think we could talk for hours and hours about safety. And
well, it doesn't hurt.
No, it doesn't. It's always good to bring safety to the forefront of, especially when it comes to patients. So again, thanks for sharing some time and some knowledge with us today. We do appreciate it. And if there's any questions, feel free to email Shared Imaging. If you want to get in contact with Bill, His website, t2star.com, and he's got a lot, or just Google him. I'm sure you'll get to where you need to be, William Faulkner at t2star.com. And with that, thanks again, Bill. We certainly appreciate your time.
Thank you, Judy. Thank you all, everybody. Appreciate the opportunity. Y'all take care.
Bill and Judy, thank you so much for joining us today to discuss the importance of MRI safety. Thank you for partnering with us to continue delivering on our commitment to putting our customers and their patients above all else. And thanks to all of you for listening to In Between the Scans. We hope you found this conversation to be valuable and that you captured some insight that can be shared with your team. As always, you can head to sharedimaging.com for more information on our podcasts and how we provide white glove service to our customers and their patients every day. If you have any questions or ideas for new segments, please don't hesitate to contact us at info@sharedimaging.com. We look forward to hearing from you.